Next had come King Robert himself, with Lady Stark on his arm. The king was a great disappointment to John. His father had talked of him often. The peerless Robert Baratheon, the demon of the Trident, the fiercest warrior of the realm, a giant among princes. John saw only a fat man, red-faced under his beard, sweating through his silks. He walked like a man half in his cups. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched with the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast.
Not a very nice quote for Robert.
Well, you know, Farrah's been in a rough spot lately. I feel like that's indicative of where they've been.
So, where they've been? Yeah. I don't think that's where they are. I don't think Farrah's as bad as most people do.
I mean, that's why I said where they've been. And of course, they've got a box coming, I hope, any day now by the time this episode drops. So we'll see. Lots of reviews from FFG lately makes me cross my fingers that by some miracle it's going to be the product that drops this month. But who knows?
Hey, Jim, what do you think?
I think Farrah has been in a rough place for a while, but that they're on the rise and that they're stronger than a lot of people think. He's got to know what to do.
So what we're saying is Jim Hansen greater than Chris Vack.
More expensive. I had more wins than him.
Welcome to the show, Jim. Aaron's barely acknowledging that you're a guest. He's just throwing you right out there into the list.
And it is at least my second time on the episode.
That's fair.
Not a complete.
The first one was quite a while ago, right?
Yeah, that was after World 2017.
Ooh, longer even than I was thinking. So, there we go. Well, good to have you back, Jim. Sorry it's been so long.
That's been all right. Glad to be back.
Well, let's go ahead and kick it over to the topic. What do we got this week, Aaron?
So, Jim made a list of 18 rules for playing House Baratheon. I didn't add to or edit the list, but I have a million thoughts on many of these things. So we're going to talk about playing Baratheon. This is the next in our series. We already did. We'll have to import what episode it is, but we already did Martell. And this is our look at playing Baratheon before the box. These tips will change, but boxes shift the meta. But unless they're like the Greyjoy box where it's just straight good stuff, it does take quite a while for a box to actually be fully figured out.
Yeah, for sure. And so I'm by no means a Baratheon loyalist. If there's anything I'm loyal to, it's bad cards.
So you are a Bera loyalist. I mean, Lanny might be giving you a run.
So I have become a Bera loyalist. Yeah, I've enjoyed my time with Lanny. I got to play some Tyrell lately. But, you know, I've been really feeling loyal to Bera the last year or so by default. I think, you know, it's a very unique faction. They're built around the power challenge. You know, in a way that's completely, you know, unparalleled by any other faction. And they have a lot of control elements to them that I think are pretty tricky. Like they don't have the big guys. They can't compete with Greyjoy or Stark at the bigs. And I think their best place is really kind of that, you know, 4 or 5 cost slot, control, power challenge based decks. So that's kind of where I see Bera at right now. You know, it's hard to say how the box is going to influence it. But that's kind of what I see out of the faction. And, you know, a lot of my tips and tricks are kind of built around on those strategies.
Okay.
With that in mind, why don't we get started? So the first one I had is a pretty simple one. It's don't forget your triggers, which you can say about any faction. Specifically, the Bera, the one I wanted to point out was Fiery Followers, in part because it's a trigger that I've forgotten many times. You know, usually during the challenges phase, you're thinking about all your triggers, then you get to dominance, and you just kind of coast along to the next plot phase, right? And so Fiery Followers is one to really remember. You know, just getting that extra power can always make a difference. You know, Bera cares more about power than any other faction, so can matter a lot.
So,
and go ahead.
I want to add something to that. Don't forget to trigger Fiery Followers. Don't forget that they have an ability. I've seen a lot of Bera players just not use the Fiery Followers in challenges and make a like chump and trigger military with a different shred. And I'm always confused. Like, use it so that you can remember to then trigger it, because it's functionally a free use unless you're giving them the other opponent renown or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's good practice to just trigger it, even if it's not going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yourself used to doing that, used to thinking about that. And so that it also kind of ties into my second tip, is that if you have extra ways to take power, like Bastard of Nightsong, Faith Militant, Clash of Kings, etc., don't be afraid to give your opponent unopposed challenges. And also avoid ties for dominance. So, you know, Bera is all about the power challenge. And to some extent, you need to generate power in the game so that you can steal it and acquire it. So, you know, I've played a lot of Bera Faith Militant decks, for example, where you're trying to steal 2, 3, 4 power from your opponents every turn. You know, not all decks are quite as aggressive as Faith Militant in that regard, but Bera in general needs power to steal. And so if your opponent is making a challenge, you know, don't block it. Let it go unopposed. Let them get a power. And similarly, going back to Fiery Followers, sometimes say you're down by 2 for dominance, and you've got the option of losing dominance or tying. Sometimes you're better off losing that dominance because it gives them a power. It creates another power in the game, in the system, that you can then take away.
I actually think that's a great tip. So many decks and games have trained me to never give away a power if I don't have to. I mean, sure, don't disrupt my own plans of attack, but if I've got a body to throw in front of a challenge, at least do that and make sure I'm not losing, you know, 11 to 10 on time or something. But with all of Baratheon's effects, that dynamic is way different for them. I admit that's something I don't think about enough, so I like that.
You know, I play a lot of rush decks in general. So, I don't know, I'm very quick to give my opponents unopposed challenges. I probably do that more than anyone else. but especially in Barra, it's something that you want to be thinking about at all times.
And just a quick reminder, in case a new player is listening, that goes semi out the window against Greyjoy.
Yes.
We Do Not Sow is still a card.
Right. You need to think about other triggers, you know. If your opponents see a blood and they're sending a 5-strength military, obviously you want to defend. But, you know, general rules of thumb here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really a difference in how Barry even control plays as compared to other control decks. Because as Bartel or Lannister, when I'm playing control, I just don't want power in the game at all. I don't want the game generating power as much as possible. Whereas with Barry, my ability to move that power where I want it and then take it in punches means I want that power in the game because it lets me go from behind to closing really quickly.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, you know, they're, in some ways they're similar to Martell in their control strategies, but it's also a very different game plan.
Yeah, they have power icons.
With Martell, no one has power
icons. Yeah, and, you know,
no one who stays on the board.
Also, you
well,
know,
I was making a joke about neither your characters nor your opponents.
Oh, ideally.
Right.
And one thing I didn't write on my list, but kind of on the same topic is, you know, if they don't have any power on their house cards, you can use your Stormlands fiefdoms to move any renown.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've got a Desert Raider to give them power, you can move that to the house card so you can steal it later.
Yeah, it's going to be really important once Melisandre's out. Mm-hmm. Also, notably for moving power stuff, if Shadows ever works for Barra, that's going to be really, really strong with Barris.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they have like 4 whole Shadows cards, but they've got to be coming, right?
There's a lot of fun tricks that Barra can do now, and it's going to get even better.
Yeah.
With manipulating power on your opponent's cards.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be really fun.
There's always just straight resetting the board after you put some power on some characters, right?
Yep.
Or making them make tough choices about who to claim for mills, so on.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's keep moving along. So my next two tips are related to Privileged Position, which I think is one of Baratheon's best cards, for those that don't recall. It's a 1-cost loyal event. I'm just trying to go off memory. But if you have not lost a power challenge this round, you can cancel an event or a location that your opponent triggers. And most people, you know, given the Sea of Blood meta, naturally, most people use that to cancel events. But there's a lot of good locations you can cancel. And, you know, things like the Wall or Flea Bottom are pretty obvious choices. But what I don't see people doing very much with it is using it in the marshalling phase.
Mm-hmm.
So you could use it on things like King's Road or Secret Schemes in marshalling or a Pleasure Barge. I mean, you think about people treachering your Pleasure Barges and your King's Roads and how sad that is, right? And now you can do that in Baratheon.
So, yeah.
You know, with that in mind, if you have a privileged position, you might want to think about going first instead of second. You know, obviously, there's a lot of things that go into choosing an initiative, but if you've got that privileged position in your hand in the pot phase, just think about that, because, you know, you need that gold to pay for it. So going first allows you to do that. Alternatively, if you're playing fealty, you can go second. You know, they'll take their first action, and then you can use your fealty to pay for that privileged position, even if you don't have any gold.
I feel like Barra, more than a lot of other factions, just doesn't mind going first. Like, beyond the kneel, a lot of their effects are stronger if you can get them off before your opponent can do anything. I'm thinking particularly of the a card that's going to come up in a couple. So I guess we'll discuss it further then. But privileged position is also significantly stronger if you're first player.
Yeah.
That's true.
Obviously.
It's interesting that you bring that up, since Neil, in previous editions, was so much stronger that those houses, or house, just a single house, Lannister really just kind of always wanted to be second. So, just interesting to see the way things have kind of shifted around with some of those strengths to different factions.
I mean, I still generally like to go second with Baera. I mean, especially if you have Mel out, and you want to see what they do before you kneel anyone. And then, you know, with the whole power challenges and generating power, you know, I like to let my opponent go first so they can get some more power, and then I can steal it back.
Yeah.
You know, it's all very situational.
What's the thought on dominance-based strategies? I feel like that also wants to go second, but I'm open to thoughts on if that's a concern.
No, yeah, you're absolutely right, because, you know, whoever goes second and is making those last challenges, they really have the most influence over who wins dominance. You know, if you really build your deck around dominance and you're going first, you basically have to pass your challenges, because otherwise your opponent will just, you know, they might poke one or two challenges at you, but then they're going to control if you win dominance or not. And especially if you're using the northern encampments that require you to win dom, otherwise you lose two gold next turn.
Yeah.
Like, I think going second is really important for dom decks. Not that I think dom decks are any good right now, but theoretically, you'd want to go second.
Yeah, I've more or less abandoned the dom strategies in almost every Baera deck. I just feel like, generally speaking, if they're working, I'm already likely to win the game.
Yeah, it's too easy to control or to stop, and I think it's just too slow right now.
Okay.
But who knows? Maybe
in the future. Who knows what's in that box?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So then my next point that's kind of tied into privileged position, but also incorporates the red keep, is to be careful with your trump power challenges. Specifically if you have the red keep or privileged position. You know, a lot of the time you might start off with, you know, sending your little one strength reducer to make a power challenge and, you know, probe your opponent's defenses. But like, if you do that with red keep, obviously, you know, losing a challenge on offense turns it off. It's not just losing a challenge on defense. So you're sacrificing two cards if you do that. Similarly with privileged position, if you make a trump power challenge and they defend it, now you've lost your ability to cancel their events or locations. And even if you don't have those cards, you still need to think about it. Because if I'm playing Baera and they limp in a power challenge and I can defend it, now I don't need to worry about privileged position. So you need to maintain that threat, even if you don't have it. And with red keep, if you can, well, I mean, this is kind of a fringe interaction. If you lose a power challenge, but then you get red keep out with support of the people, I'm pretty sure it's still shut off for that turn. You know, that's a weird situation where you're A, losing a power challenge, yeah, and B, winning a power challenge by five.
But I mean, if you're wanting to let stuff go unopposed, I could see situations where you let that chump power go because you're planning on cracking back. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a totally far-fetched situation.
Or something, you know, coming back to if you're going first, you know, sometimes it can be hard to win a power challenge on offense and be able to defend your own power challenge on defense. You know, if you're really trying to protect that red keep and get the extra draw, sometimes you just have to skip that power challenge in your first player.
I think Starry Sept basically might as well just be a Baera card. It, between Fury and everything else, it's just completely amazing in the faction.
Yeah, it's the best bear location they've got in a long time. So I think you're transitioning into my next point, number five.
Can I throw out one thing before you get all the way into number five, though? Just because you've got me really thinking now about between number four and number two, both of these challenge-related ones, where it's something that I hadn't slowed down to think about so much before. I had done these sort of things in-game as far as, you know, not throwing the chump power challenge out when you've got the red keep, that sort of thing. But I hadn't really stopped to put the pieces together that, you know, folks look at Night's Watch, particularly core wall decks, right? And the way it interacts with the challenge phase very differently from all of the other houses. But I hadn't really stopped to think, like, really, when you put these pieces together, Baratheon interacts with the challenge phase and the challenges themselves actually quite differently from a lot of other houses, between letting things go unopposed and having to really manage that power challenge as a double-edged sword, shall we say. I'm trying to think. The only other house that's maybe associated with a single challenge as much as Baratheon is maybe Lannister with Intrigue. But they're just kind of encouraged, I think, to just slam those out as much and as fast as possible. Whereas Baratheon's, I think, is much more nuanced and just, I think, really requires a different sort of look at what your game plan is that I like. They are really revolving around maximizing what does amount to being the win condition, right? The power challenges lead to power, whereas so many other houses are just looking for what effectively earns them the most tempo at any given time, rather than looking straight to that end game. So I like that you've got me thinking more about that interaction with these tips. So
yeah, you're absolutely right there, Will. Like in part because of how bad their cards are right now, like if you're just playing straight up challenges and tempo, it's not gonna work. But they have so many tools built around the power challenge. I mean, you could lose every single military and intrigue challenge the entire game, but if you're winning your power challenges, like you can still find a path to victory.
Yeah. Yeah. I've played games with, Starry Sept, as we were starting to kind of drift toward, where I literally made no challenge except for power challenges, and I only had, like, two characters on the board most of the game, and still got to 15, or was very close before, you know, the other person wiped my board completely. Like, it's an interesting change of pace.
Yeah.
No, please.
I think it's really... Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say, I mean, I think that's really where their strength is right now. And if you're not building around the power challenge...
There's a reasonable
Barra,
amount of time.
You're probably going to lose.
Where with Barra, I just don't make military challenges. Okay. Like, it's just, I'm intrigue and power, intrigue and power. You have less options when I'm playing with them.
Yeah.
I just don't care about... I just don't care about military because they have enough crap on the board that, like, unless I'm trying to kneel something, I just don't care. Yeah, that's what fiery followers are for, right?
You know, Judd challenge. Anyway, because.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know, maybe it goes unopposed and you get a power, and that's really all you care about.
sure.
All right, should we move on to five?
Yeah.
So Aaron had mentioned Starry Sept and Fury. And so this is a reminder that Support of the People, which is practically a Baratheon card right now, Support of the People shares the same reaction window as Starry Sept and Fury. Or, and if you're really out there, Street of the Sisters. So these all have the same reaction that say when you win a power challenge by 5, do X. And so when you trigger that support of the people, 1 gold, search your deck. Get that Starry Self, trigger it. Get that Fury, trigger it. So I think, you know, a lot of Bera decks, you can run these, you can run a really fun toolbox suite of locations, and really leverage support of the people. Not to mention that they've got the tools to win by 5 better than any faction right now. But it really gives you options. A, you know, if you want to search for that Starry Scepter Fury to close the game, or B, if you want to find Dragonstone Castle or Red Keep or whatever you need. So it's a really good event for them right now. But it's just infinitely better if you remember that you can trigger that location right away.
How many events are you thinking of running? Because now we're at, I'm assuming, 2 to 3 support and 3 privilege.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bear decks I've been playing typically run 3 privilege position. And then you're looking at, you know, if it's really built around the power challenge, you probably want to have 2 support of the people. If you're running the Relore package, Seen in Flames is still amazing. And then In the Name of Your King is also a very strong card. They all fit into the different decks. Yeah, you know, that's the faction, you know, which we'll touch on later. But I think generally speaking, you want to have 3 privileged positions, and then probably 2 or 3 other events at 2x. That's kind of where I'm landing right now. You know, it varies by deck. Events especially vary dramatically depending on your agendas. You know, one of the best Bera decks right now is the Kohor deck, Banner Rose, and you know, that's running mostly attachments anyway, so you don't have room for events. But privilege position first, and support of the people if you can fit it. I think that's a good starting spot for a lot of Bera decks.
Yeah.
Okay. On to number 6. Dragonstone Castle can be effectively used in both challenges or standing phase. So Dragonstone Castle, you trigger it at the beginning of a phase, and it says your opponent's character can't stand until the end of the phase. And so the obvious thing to use it for is in standing, that you can keep your opponent's best character knelt. So, you know, 90% of the time, that's probably what you're going to be doing. But you can also use it in the challenges phase. And, you know, if they have their Randall Tarly, or they got their Big Vic, and you say, hey, you can't stand at all for the rest of the phase. Or Danny, you know, if you're playing Targaryen. Or someone with Queen's Guard, you know. There's a lot of good options where you can really leverage that in the challenges phase. But I think it's something that a lot of people don't think about, myself included. I played Baratheon Faith at the Windy City Cup back in January, and that was the first time I've ever put Dragonstone Castle in a deck. But I played against Greyjoy Sea of Blood in the top 4, and he had Big Vic out there, and I had my Dragonstone Castle, and I just kept using it in the standing phase, and then after the game, I was just like, oh, I could use that in the challenges phase, and I might have won that game. So I learned that one the hard way. But, yeah. It's a really versatile card. And a really great 1x in a deck with support of the people. Okay. So I'm going to move on to number 7. Use Stormlands Fiefdom in standing if you have unprotected power. Protect your Fickle Bannerman last because Stormlands Fiefdom moves power to the owner's faction card. So as a reminder, this is, we're talking about the Baratheon non-limited 2 gold econ location. You need it to move the power. from a character or location to its owner's faction card. And the, you know, Baratheon has a lot of ways to get power on fairly expendable characters, you know, especially if you're playing Faith Militants. If you're running Poor Fellows or Fickle Bannermen, you might have a lot of chuds that have power on them. Or sometimes with your Starry Sept, you might have power on it. And you're worried about a political disaster. But mainly we're talking about characters here, where your opponent might reset soon. So if you've got that power on your Poor Fellows, you want to protect it. And so that's what makes Stormlands Fiefdom, I think it's a very good card in Baratheon. But the point here was that you can use it in the standing phase. So, you know, maybe you've got two power on your Poor Fellows because you got one from the reaction and one from Faith Militant. You know, so you use it once in challenges to bank one of that power. And then in the standing, you can use the location again to bank that second power.
So Dragonstone Castle is also a really good HRD location. And when the box comes out, now the name escapes me, but what's the name of the agenda that's in the box? Oh, Prince That Was Promised?
Yeah.
If the Prince That Was Promised begins to overrun the meta, then Dragonstone Castle HRD is going to be a really solid answer to that.
Because that stands a character and draws a card, is that right?
Yeah. If they can't stand, then that fancy character that they're so happy with is no longer worth the investment.
Oh, fancy characters.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about the new agenda, but that's a good point. Okay, so let's move on to number 7.
Sure.
So this is talking about Stormlands Fiefdom, which is the non-limited 2-gold Baratheon econ location. You can kneel to move a power from a character or location to its owner's faction card. It's a really good effect for Baratheon. I think it's one of the stronger non-limited locations. I think I might be in the minority there, but Bear is able to leverage it pretty well. Mm-hmm. But so the point with this one was to use it in the standing phase if you have unprotected power. So Baratheon has a lot of chuds that can acquire power. You know, they have the Fickle Bannermen, and there's also the Poor Fellows, which might as well be a Baratheon character. In part because they don't have any other good 2-cost characters, and in part because I think they can leverage Faith Militant very well. But the point is, you're going to have power sometimes on your characters, sometimes also on Starry Sept, and you need to protect it from resets or military claim or whatever. So use that Stormlands Fiefdom to bank the power on your characters, and then remember to use it again in the standing phase if you're worried about a reset. If you end up, you know, having one or more power on your chuds and you think they might reset next turn, or even if you're not sure if they're going to reset, just always bank that power. Don't let it go to waste. You know, like I've said before, you know, every power makes a difference when you're playing Baratheon. And then a finer point.
Go ahead.
A finer point with the Fickle Bannermen in particular is that the Stormlands Fiefdom moved it to its owner's faction card. So even if you have a Fickle Bannerman that you lose, that your opponent takes because you lost the power challenge, that power will still come back to your faction card. So if you happen to have a Fickle Bannerman and a Poor Fellows, you should bank that Poor Fellows power first, because you can bank the Fickle Bannerman power later, even if you lose them.
Oh, you know what? I admit I had completely overlooked that before. Man, moving to the owner's house card, that actually makes the Fickle Bannerman vastly more interesting.
Yeah, and then another fun interaction is with the Lore Infiltrator. is if you give that to your opponent, now you can just put power on it. You know, if you have a Desert Raider or whatever, or if you have a what's the event that kneels up to
yep, that thing.
Oh,
that thing, my core set.
Yeah, dang it.
It's not important.
It's gonna kill me.
You can just put power on the Relar Infiltrator and then steal it back to your faction card.
How about consolidation of power? Nice. I knew it had power right there.
There you go.
One of my favorite moves with the fiefdom is if I have the Master of Night Song out, or if I'm playing Faith Milton, which, let's be honest, if I'm playing Baron, I'm probably playing Faith Milton right now. I let them get that extra renown, and then they could win the power challenge, but they figure it's only one claim, and they don't have the power on their house, or they don't have the second power on their house. So I go out of their way to stop it, and you can move the power like right off their guy to gain that power really quickly. And it's at, ooh, like that surprise yeah. quick, like, and now I'm getting close on power, and you weren't really ready as great.
I like that.
Also, that character you own is going to make this really, I never noticed it either, is going to make this really hilariously good against New Wall.
Oh, yeah!
Got my Bob? Can't get any power on him.
Thank you for every challenge you make.
But yeah, you know, that using the fiefdom on your opponent's cards to give you more power to steal. It's really just that's a very fundamental, important thing, especially with Night Song and Faith Militant. Make sure you're getting every power that you can.
I think the card is phenomenal.
Right. Anything else? That's very good.
Yeah.
The fiefdom? Okay. Just making sure you were talking that, not the Bannerman that we kind of wanted
to. Yeah, Fury is good.
Yeah, I think the...
I still think this, but I'm not the expert we invited on.
With support of the people, I think it can be very good. It's definitely situational. And with the
right.
That's where the real combo is. You know, blank their guy, and then steal the power back. So you know, it's all kind of tying back into what I think is a really fun strategy of using power as a resource, as a tool.
I only really like it with Starry Sept. Otherwise, I feel like it's just too often a dead card, unless I'm running a bunch of Korean Seth Mantis, in which case it's back to being amazing.
Yeah. All right. On to number 8. Be careful of your faction card kneeling effects. In particular, Solis in the name of your king, your agenda, compete for it. And then watch out for Bill Bone and Withering Cold is another really interesting one.
Mm.
So, you know, I think of all the factions, Baratheon might have the most real faction kneel effects. I don't know, Martell has a lot. But, you know, Solis is a big one that you need the faction kneel for. In the name of your king. It's a really strong game-swinging event right now that you need the faction kneel for. You know, Faith Militant is one of their best agendas. That requires the faction kneel. So, you know, both when you're playing the game and when you're building your deck, you need to think about what you're going to kneel your faction card for every turn. And, you know, Bill Bone is in just about every deck. If your opponent's got a card in Shadows and a gold, you need to think about, are they going to kneel my faction card?
Mm-hmm.
And is that going to screw me? Hopefully not. And then, yeah, the last card I mentioned is Withering Cold. You know, that you probably see that more in Baratheon than any other deck because of their effects like Solis and the other kneel effects. But you need to remember that that kneels your faction card doesn't stand on the Withering Cold turn. So if you're planning to Solis one turn and then maybe Iron Bank or back.
You can't Iron Bank anyway, because that's also a faction meal.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, normally, you know, if you're playing some Bear Wars to Come deck, for example, maybe your plan would be to Solis on turn one, Iron Bank turn two, Solis turn three, you know, that sort of thing. But Withering Cold interrupts that. So keep that in mind. I actually tend to not use Withering Cold in Neil deck for that reason.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
I don't generally think Withering Cold is a good card. Like, it can swing a game, but it's very easy for it to just be kind of a half-dead plot. Like, there's a lot of stand in this game. It's why I like the Faith Milton so much more than the standard Niels. It's just, there's so much stand in the game, at least until the new Bobby comes out.
I think the only deck I would run Withering Cold in right now is with Korob, where you can just, you know, leverage that as a very one-sided
event.
But I don't think it has a good place in Barrow.
Makes sense to me.
All right. So number nine, Peace and Prosperity is a great Baratheon card. Be careful with your marshalling sequence, especially avoiding reducers. So as a reminder, so Peace and Prosperity, it's a 2 gold, 3 initiative.
You're right. You're completely right. Yeah. I should probably you got it. Stop.
Good job.
But usually I know these things. So it reduces the cost of the first character you marshal by 3, the first location by 2, and the first attachment by 1. So I think it's a really strong opener, especially in the days when Summer Harvest was everywhere. Or Riddle, or if you're worried about Naval, or Martell, like it's a very safe, sound opener. You'll always have a character, and if you have a location, you can bank that 2 gold off the location. It's effectively a 7 gold, 3 initiative opener pot, which is very strong. But you need to remember that it's the first character you marshal, and the first location that you marshal. What you can't do marshal your 1-cost reducer and then use him to reduce your next character. Because then you're wasting that 3 gold reduction on your chud. Similarly, you can't, you know, say you've got a red keep in hand and you want to reduce it by 3 instead of 2, so you play that whatever it is, Dragonstone
Port. Yeah. I'm guilty of that one.
Don't do that.
So guilty.
Don't do that. You wasted your 2 gold. We've all done it. I've done it. Everyone's done it.
I play that pot whenever, like, 15 decks, and I'm so careful with it. Sean Paul yells at me about it all the time. He's like, that plot is trash. Yeah. I'm like, no, you just have to think. That plot feels
you gotta really
in Hollow Hill.
Ooh, yeah, that could be good.
I mean, it's functionally 10 gold worth of cards, right? 11 if you have an
investor.
Yeah, but you're probably opening. You're probably better off opening Fallen from
Faith. Almost certainly. I don't think it's an opener there. I think it's like. I can see that as your recovery. 10 gold is, like, mid game, is a really reasonable amount. Especially, like, as a post PD, I want to get some econ stuff going. Probably not in Barra. But, like. You PD, then you Peace and Prosperity to get yourself back in the game. Like, being able to play 5-8 gold worth of characters and then still get another location in play seems strong.
Hey, and maybe an attachment for gravy, who knows?
Yeah. Milk, free milk.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Attachments to gravy, yeah. But, you know, Baratheon specifically, for one thing, they don't have very many good 2-cost characters, so you're mostly you're going to be playing a lot of 3, 4, and 5. So the 3 gold reduction on the first character doesn't feel too awkward. One limitation with that is it's hard to play a 6 or 7 cost character because you only have 2 gold from the pot plus 3 reduction. But I think most Baratheon decks right now shouldn't really be playing at that cost slot anyway. So it works out pretty well for the characters. And then on the location front, you know, they have a lot of very good locations that cost 2 or more. You've got the Stoneman's Fiefdom, you've got Red Keep, Golden Chair, Starry Step, Dragonstone Castle. You know, hopefully if you're running the Support of the People package, you have a lot of locations that cost two or three. So, you know, with that sort of package, you're almost always going to be able to get that 2 gold reduction off of your Peace and Prosperity. So I think it's a very good trading with the Horror Pot and a lot of
red. Horror any good? Oh, that I hear that's a deck. That's
the Rose Core Horde's very good.
I've heard rumors.
That's a deck, and then the Lanny Stag.
Right. I wonder. Hey, who played that deck? Someone winning a flight with that deck, I think.
Well, I mean,
didn't you? Aren't you in the lead for flight in a certain California league? Yeah, based on a win with that deck.
Oh, that's right.
That league is brutal. It's really impressive that you're doing.
Yeah.
Like.
We should probably give cut. There's a California online league that I've worked my way into despite not living in California. I forget exactly how it happened. I think Dave Moran has promised a fight to worlds for whoever does the best on the gear. And I managed to win one of the seasons playing that.
Roll Johnny Wright, which is literally, I think, the difference in the league right now because he's in second.
I'm up 1 point on him. But, you know, so Nico kind of initially made that deck, and then Hano was working on it, and then I was kind of independently working on it. We got together, and I think got it into a pretty good place. He posted that deck, and I played it at Bones War. I made the cut. Not tier one right now, but it's a deck that leverages.
It's red. Also a hell of a good war format deck.
Very nice.
A lot of decks just don't have an answer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's got a lot of fun tools in it.
On to 10?
Okay. On to number 10. Oh, this should be a short one. Ours is the Fury. Can be a great card. But remember that
this is like this is one of the go first cards I was thinking of earlier.
So, yeah. This isn't a card that has seen a lot of play. So as a reminder, it's a 2 gold event that mid-challenge you can jump one of your kneeling Baratheon characters into the challenge. Does it have to be on defense specifically?
So choose a kneeling Baratheon character. It is considered defender in the character in the challenge. If you win that challenge, stand that character.
That card has blown me up
more than almost any other bearer card in the history of the game. I constantly forget that damn card exists at the worst time, and it's just like, oh, look, Bob's standing. Shit, I lost.
Yeah, obviously the best target is Bob, because you're going to win that challenge, and then you're going to win whatever the next challenge is, because now Bob's standing, and, you know, by this point, there's lots of known characters. But getting back to your point, going first with Baratheon is good because you can make your challenge with Bob, kneel out there, guys, and then whatever they swing back with, you can jump Bob.
And it ignores icons, too. So, like, it's really nice to do that on the intrigue, win an intrigue with Bob, and then it's like, well, so much for my military power.
Ignores icons or ignores stealth. You can use it to get multiple Bastard of Night Song triggers. If it worked out.
I feel like that's notable. Bastard of Night Song works on defense. We didn't actively say, but it is worth realizing.
Yep. He's power challenge only though, so you can't.
I mean,
sneak him into an intrigue challenge with this and trigger him, but I have at least once done it in a power
two. Nice. Defense.
I mean, just remember, and I think you guys are. I think you're neglecting the fact that this card can be such a blowout in melee. Probably the only format I've seen this played consistently.
What's I don't understand. What's a melee?
Exactly.
It should be in Joustex. It's really, really great. Although in a mid, if all your characters are cost 5 or less, I'm not sure if I would run it.
Yeah, I mean, it's great with Bob. If you're not running Bob,
yeah,
or you know, maybe like a Voltron Stannis.
Yeah, new Stannis. This is.
If you're just running that low curve, I don't think.
Wait, it really is new Stannis immune to events or immune to your opponent's events? Okay, because if it's opponent's events, he's an amazing target for this.
I think it's opponents, but let's find out. Opponents.
Yep.
I thought that Stannis was bad, and then Roy yelled at me a lot, and I was like, maybe I should consider, and then Colt just openly mocked me for like an hour. I was like, fine, new Stannis is good, let's move on.
Wait, so your opinion was changed on it just because people were like arguing? Not because like you played it in a
it's
game.
It's not out.
Colt crushed you with it or anything.
So if
they just mocked you until you changed your opinion.
If Colt Humbert tells me a card is good and that I'm dumb for not liking it, odds are he's right. Right? Like, like sometimes he just likes some crazy jank shit. But if he's like, no, this card is like near busted good, he's probably right. Just I've come to terms with that. I don't really have a problem with it anymore.
I tell you what, I will be eager to see the performance it puts on as near busted. I'm eager to be proven wrong on this.
It's Barry could just really use the draw, and immune to events is extremely strong in the meta. Ooh. Also, I'm gonna slop a card when we get to plop and slops or props and slops remind me.
Okay.
This is a card that came out last pack that I super duper hate. Alright, go for it.
Alright. Okay, number 11. This is my only tip that's related to an actual dominance deck. But Saving the Kingdom is an amazing card. And you can cycle it very easily with the Light of the Lord attachment. So, you know, Saving the Kingdom is their reusable 2 gold event. You can choose a Neela character strength 3 or less, and they don't stand during the standing phase that turn. So you're getting the Neela for 2 rounds, which is very strong. I mean, there's a lot of really good targets to hit with that. You know, you got your Theons, like a Maester Molendor or something. You know, like Mr. Aemon. I don't know. There's so many targets. There's always going to be someone good to hit with that. And
yeah.
Up for 2 turns, like an Arya, it is a very strong.
So game. After the first turn, you're basically
and
2 of their characters from then on out, as long as you win dominance. Like, 2 of them will be knelt as of the challenge phase once you play this for that new round. That's pretty sweet.
Yep. And, you know, it helps itself to recycle because, you know, so to get it back, you need to win dominance and pay a gold. And if the characters are knelt, that obviously helps. But another of the fun attachment that I've used to some success in dominance decks is Light of the Lord, which is a 2-cost attachment that goes in a Baratheon or Reload character. Reaction after the dominance phase begins, stand attached character and gain a gold. So, I think, you know, dominance decks right now, the Iron Throne is just not enough. You know, 8 strength isn't enough, and Frozen Solid is a card. So, if you're really making a dominance deck, you need to have redundancy. And Light of the Lord is very good. You know, if you put that on your Bob, now you're getting probably 10, 15 strength for dominance out of a 2 gold card. Even if you're just putting it on a Bastard of Night song, you're getting 5 strength off of that, plus the 1 gold. So you'd be getting 6 to help your dominance. So not only does it help you win that dominance, but if you're really building around it, you really need to win it. But then it gives you that gold that you can immediately then use to get
which
back
is pretty cool.
In the kingdom. Which again will help you win dominance in the future. So it all just, you know, really fuels itself. And I think any half decent dominance deck right now out of Baratheon probably needs to build around these two cards.
Speaking of fueling itself, I do like that your rules are basically fueling themselves. Because talking about Light of the Lord can't help but remind me of your first rule. Don't forget to trigger Fiery Followers, which also might as well read, don't forget to trigger Light of the Lord in this context. So there you go.
Yep. There you go.
It's generally a solid rule for the game.
It is. It is. This just happened to be essentially the same trigger.
Every game I forget one trigger hardcore. Sorry, every tournament. It usually doesn't happen more than once per tournament, because once I've done it, I get real obsessive about never doing it again. I missed a Intimidate.
Yeah, don't miss the same trigger
against
twice.
Cameron, and it cost me the game.
So that means
it was, like, I made my challenge, and then he was like, all right, so I military you back, and I was like, wait, you don't have anyone? Oh, I just didn't do that. Cool.
Nice.
Yeah, because I was already planning my plot phase, and I was like, oh, right. Good memories. All right, next thing.
All right, number 12. So this is talking about Disputed Claim, which is one of my favorite Baratheon cards. The 1 gold attachment that goes on a bastard lord or lady. So if you have more power on your faction card, character gains plus 2 strength and renown. And the key thing to remember about this card is that renown is checked after claim and unopposed and reaction. So you might go into a power challenge. Say you've got a Bastard Knight song with disputed claim on him. You know, at Thrones War 2018, I played Baratheon Crossing that really leveraged Disputed Claim. And there were several times where I would start a power challenge down by 5 or more power. And by the time I got to keywords, I had more power. You know, you can get between Lord of the Crossing, Unopposed Claim, Bastard of Night Song, Spear Claim if you're running that, which I was. You can get a lot of power, and by the time you get to keywords, all of a sudden your disputed claim is turned on. And so then you can get that extra power. Similarly, if you're playing one of these Cahor decks that we've talked about, either the Bear of Rose or the Lanny Stag, you get that attachment after claim is checked, but before keywords. So you can go fetch your disputed claim, throw it on your Cersei, or your Andaltar, well, he wouldn't need it, but whatever. Throw it on whoever you want, and get that power right away. Similarly, don't get rid of your disputed claim before you grab renown.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
I've done that before. So, you just need to think about the timing and everything.
Reasonably cool would be what the Tyrell one, that if you win by 5, you get a power. Do you know what that one is? You know what I'm talking
about?
Oh,
the attachment.
No, the attachment that does it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, crap. I know the one you're talking about. But can't think of it.
So there's a there's basically a honey wine attachment.
And yeah,
speaking of the South,
yeah.
Doing that into disputed claim seems real good.
Ooh.
Although, you know, I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but the plus 2...
Yeah, yeah, you wouldn't get the strength, you would just get 2 power from the challenge.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, and also Beacon gives it to the character, not the house card, so that might matter for Disputed Claim.
But yeah, you know, in a cohort deck, yeah, you can get that power from the beacon, then go sack the beacon, fetch it as being claimed. So your one attachment could
get... Seems good in certain situations.
Yeah.
Where, you know, where you want power and stuff.
I can't think of any of those.
Hey, you're about to talk about my favorite Barrow card. Let's do this.
All right. So number 13, this is talking about Queensmen, which I think is one of Baratheon's best cards. You know, at least when I was building with Baratheon for Throne War 2018, my conclusion was that Queensmen was the best Baratheon card since the core set. I'm not sure if that's still true, but nonetheless, it's a very strong card. And so, you know, this is a pretty basic, I think, but if you have Queensmen, you need a non-Baratheon character to do the second part, which is discarding a card from their hand. So obviously, marshal that other character first. Playing a lot of Faith Militant, that usually means your poor fellows. Sometimes one of the other three guild characters, but rush that poor fellows first, and then play the Queensmen. Or, if you're on your Peace and Prosperity turn, don't marshal poor fellows, marshal a three guild character instead, marshal them first, and then marshal your Queensmen, so you can trigger it and discard the card. But, at the same time, if you don't have a good character to kneel, sometimes it's worth playing the Queensmen just to see your opponent's hand. Don't just sit on them forever. Or sometimes you just need that R'hllor trait for maybe a Melisandre trigger or to be able to play in flame. So there are times that it's worth it to just marshal them anyway. But don't waste it if you can.
This is another go first card for me. Like, getting rid of that milk before they have a chance to use it is often completely huge. Getting rid of an Iron Bank will have its due, or a pinch of powder, or Clever Fate, like, all have 1B games before, where if they can just start getting that cycle going, I'm dead. But, like, just being able to immediately chuck that is extremely, before they can marshal it, is extremely strong. This is going to be especially important because, like, I'm not sure what stops Box Bobby Baratheon besides milk, and using this card as a way to say that you can't have a milk seems really, really strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even just the hand knowledge, I think, is really worthwhile. I mean, like in our recent review talking about Ghost of Pyheart, just I highly rate even just the hand knowledge portion. If circumstances dictate you can't discard, it still gives you a lot of opportunity to outplay if you've got that skill level to start with.
Well, that's a very good point about going first. You know, nothing is more frustrating than losing a card from your hand before you ever had a chance to play it.
Mm-hmm.
You draw it in the draw phase, you get to marshaling, and it's gone before you even get a chance. Like, that is so frustrating. I remember at Jesse's name day about a month ago, in the side event, I was playing against a Drowned God deck, and we were both top decking, and like, I drew my two cards, and he marshaled the Bastard Daughter and then killed it with his Vince in his dead pile. It's like, oh, I just lost one of my two cards before I could even use it.
I beat it.
Ouch.
I beat a Greyjoy with New Wall earlier. They were first. They played a reducer. I knelt my get two gold thing. Took something out of their... they knelt the reducer. I took whatever out of their discard, and then they knelt their other reducer, and then I had their Victarion, which they were about to marshal with all their reducers, and it was just like, oh. Well then, it's like, yeah, you probably should have just played that. Like, it's just, what do you do?
Yeah. It also reminds me of one of my favorite Baratheon decks. But not your one by any means. But you know, the if you combine Barra and Greyjoy with cards like Nighttime Marauders and can do a lot of really fun hand destruction. And I just remember I was playing around with that for a while, and I had a deck that opened False Spring, which discarded the card from your opponent's hand, and then he can trigger Queensmen and trigger Nighttime Marauders. I remember there was one game where turn one, before my opponent got the Marshal, I had discarded like that.
Yep.
Something absurd.
Just sad days.
Really fun to do, and probably really sucks to play against. But, yeah. Going on a little bit of a tangent. Okay, so then one last thing about Queensmen is that you should do it.
Yeah.
That's getting that hand knowledge of your opponent before you've done the rest of your marshaling can be very valuable. You can see, oh, do I need to save for this in the name of your king? Should I be saving the gold or saving the kingdom? Or whatever. My safe to marshal. Just getting that hand knowledge first. Kind of similar to what you had said in the Martell episode about using your secret schemes for the exact.
I very much agree. Also, being able to chuck your opponent's secret schemes before they can use it is real sad for them. I've taken to doing everything humanly possible in the draw phase. Draw phase is my new phase to trigger shit. There's just too much cancel.
And then sometimes you need to really be careful about every action. You know, if you're playing against Martell and their first action is to kneel a Dornish fiefdom, and then their second action could be to play the Queen. But if you do that Queensland first.
Yeah.
Okay. Move on to number 14. Close to the end here. So this is talking about Forced March, because it has some specifically interesting interactions with Barathe. The main thing I want to mention is Duel, because Duel is a pretty good Barathe plot, especially if you're, you know, if you're not running Bob, then you're probably not running any 6 or 7 costumes.
Yes.
And at that point, yeah, anyway, yeah. Everything might change when the new box comes out. But right now, if you're running a Faith Militant or even like a Bear of Wars, there's a lot of decks that don't have those big guys. And Duel can just really swing a game. You know, you can kill your dupe, your opponent's dupe big, and the other guy, like, you're gonna win that round. That's really good. But, I swear to God, half the time I play Duel, my opponent plays Forest March. And so what you need to remember, this is kind of a weird interaction, but if there are no standing targets for Duel, they need to choose a standing character, they need to choose a character to kill and a character to kneel. And if they can't kneel anymore,
however, if only one is knelt,
so
the other one just dies.
Only one is knelt, then yes, exactly. Which, if you sometimes you can use Dragonstone Castle to keep one of their big knelts, so then you get to choose which one dies and which one kneels. But the point, anyway, with Force March is your opponent's going to win initiative, and they can choose to kneel out all their big guys if they have military icons. And if you have military icons, which most of the time is going to be the case, because we're probably talking about Greyjoy or Targaryen primarily right now, or Stark. So, you know, if they have Fat Cat, then it's not an issue, but most of the time, they're going to be able to kneel off their bigs
and cancel your duel. One of the rules of Martell, which is true, I think, almost everywhere, is I would consider Duel a reset-esque plot. Anytime you want to reset, unless you're going to immediately use the game, don't use it the turn it's obvious. Use it the turn after. Just wait one more turn, and you can usually avoid that.
On the flip side, there's been several times where I waited that extra turn on Duel,
Second one, then you just cry. Like, what do you do? You cry. The thing I like least about Duel, and I love Duel, it was in my Jesse's Name Day deck. Like, it's one of my favorite plots. The thing I really hate about Duel is how much draw they've given both Stark and Greyjoy at this point. Means that, like, I often get that, like, great Duel off, and then they're just like, all right, I'm going to drop two more six costers, and then I cry. Because, like, what do I do, like, at that point, except be sad? Like, I really wish Duel wasn't limit one per plot deck. Not that I'd necessarily run two, but I really want the threat of running two. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that's OP. Yeah. I think that's fairly balanced, but what are you going to do?
Sometimes it's going to whiff, sometimes it's going to do nothing, sometimes it's not going to be enough, but sometimes...
I mean, when you see Alex Hines, you should ask him how Duel is plot deck limit one, but the Annals of Castle Black is not.
It's called Playtesters Didn't Like One of Them, right. Probably.
And then on the flip side, one thing you can do with Force March, your own benefit, if you're playing the 7 gold bears from Somi, you can kneel him and then use him. So if your opponent's in the Valor, you've got Barristan, you can use Force March as a save. Kind of a fringe case. But something to think about. Similarly, with Ours is the Fury, which we talked about before, you know, don't be afraid to maybe kneel that extra character. Because you know that you can trigger your Ours.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. I never really thought about that Ours is the Fury interaction.
I can't say I've ever actually done it before, but you know, I was just thinking about Force March and something you could do.
Huh.
So if you wanted to go second and still be sure that you
could... I've never done the Baratheon one, Barristan one, but I've had it done to me as I realized what was happening and slowly went, oh no.
I feel like that one more folks have jumped on, but that Ours is the Fury play. That's cool. That's really cool.
You can also do similar tricks with Even-Handed Justice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the more common play with Barristan, is you would use that in standing. But you can also do it. You can even do it, I mean, you have to be saving a lot of gold. But you could Even-Handed Justice mid-challenge.
Hey.
And use Ours as the Fury to jump your guy in.
Other notable thing for Force March Duel, you don't even have to protect against it if one of the expensive dudes doesn't have a military icon because, I don't know, you're playing Banner of the Sun or one is Wyman. Like, there will be a standing dude. Don't stress it.
Yeah, sometimes you don't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. On to number 15. This is talking about the 2 gold core set Dream Baratheon. And it's a pretty simple tip. It's just don't always kill her right away. Consider saving for a more impactful moment. Later. I think a lot of times, to some extent, this applies to the Bastard Daughter out of Martell as well. Sometimes people are just really eager to get that trigger. And kill her off right away. You can save it, especially for like a Valor turn, you know, where they're just saving their one big, and now they're knelt out, and got no one to challenge it. That can often be a lot more impactful. Think about it.
Yeah. I've seen people wildfire her away, like turn two. I'm like, is that a thing? Just, okay. Like, leave her there because sometimes opponents just won't military you, and that seems like a useful thing.
Yeah, exactly. Just a threat. So talking about Shireen, but now we're going to switch gears to the
Regal. Oh, hey, can I say a thing about which one to run? If you're running a Sun deck and you're running Desert Raider, run 3 Gold Shereen. All you're ever killing is Desert Raider over and over and over and over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
Like, 2 Gold Shereen just has significantly less value at that point.
That makes sense.
Yep. So yeah, the 3 Gold Shereen, you know, she has this ability where she can remove, basically remove herself and an opponent's character from the challenge, or at least the doesn't contribute.
Yeah, that's the big difference that applies. So,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so the way that interacts with the red keep is very important, because you still have a participating character, and you still count the 2 strength from the red keep. So if it's just, if you just have Shereen, and your opponent just has the one character, you win that challenge. And, you know, she's a very expensive shadow card. I recall she's 3 gold to bring out of shadows, 3 gold to Marshall. But a lot of the times it's really not worth it to use her shadows ability. But having that surprise, your opponent swings in based on their Bobby B or whoever on the power challenge. And then you just say, oh, here's a little Shereen Baratheon. I got my red keep. I win that challenge. So if you're not going to use her right away, then consider just putting her in
Also, if you have red keep and your opponent only has one power icon, you can auto win a power challenge. Because the red keep strength is not blanked. Yeah. They're still both in the challenge. Yeah.
Your only
2-0. Nice win. Nightmares isn't seeing as much play as it really should. If Stark's going to be everywhere, Nightmares should be seeing more play. Nightmares.
Okay. So the last two are kind of short deck building things. One, the number 17 here, we've already touched on a little bit. But Desert Raider is your friend. You know, I think Baratheon Sun is probably one of the strongest decks right now. In part because, you know, that power that you give your opponent, you can often steal back. And they're very good against Sea of Blood, Desert Raider, and all the icons. That's all worked out very nicely. And then on the flip side, if your opponent's running Desert Raider, that means they're putting power on your characters. And, oh look, you have Stormlight Speak. So, like, yeah, on the flip side, you know, try and trigger their Desert Raiders maybe more than they normally would, and remember to bank that power.
Desert Raider's a good card. You should play Desert Raiders. If the deck can, if a deck can play Desert Raider, the rule is it should play 3 Desert Raider. Like, I don't think that's, like, being able to say, even if it doesn't always work out that way, that your military challenge isn't worthwhile, is good. Like, it's the reason that Doran has to stay restricted, because otherwise I don't really think Doran should be restricted. Because I think Martell might actually be the second worst faction at this point. But, yeah, I think Martell has fallen off a cliff with
that's bold.
Both No Surprises and Ghost of High Heart. Like, those are real, real bad cards for Martell. But,
I do want to see No Surprise out in the wild more before making that judgment.
So I played a week of Stark. No Surprises is a little bit busted. Like, if Stark claims a board, it's really hard to take back that board. Like, because you can't really use attachments or things like tears. You need to get, like, a C trigger or something. But they have Winterfell, and, like, it's really hard to reset them because, I don't remember what 461 is called. Do you guys help? Because Return to the Fields is printed,
Return to the Fields.
Like, or they can just air something away and not save it, right? Like, But with all of those options, like Stark is very hard to deal with once they claim the board. Like, and the, when you finally can get that trigger off, if you're using shadows or ambush stuff, like to just be able to say, okay, you can't burn my cards for this turn while I get set up, while I set up, make sure everything's good, is insanely strong. Or to say that, like, no, I don't have to worry about tears or ends for Elia, or like, I'm going to military you, and for this round, you cannot play Risen from the Sea. But, like, and that's all without considering the fact that, like, a Shadows deck that's basically putting everything to Shadows just immediately loses because you just lost 6 power, 6 to 8 power non-opposed. But, like, yeah, just the event thing completely owns a lot of decks and has already changed the way I'm building things. Have you tried it yet, Jim?
Yep. I haven't tried it yet. I had it played against me once.
Yeah. I mean, I lost. Like, right? Like, I just sat there with my 8 cards in Shadows, feeling bad about myself as they used Fast Eddie to get, like, a bajillion power. And then reset because they were closing immediately directly into a 4-6-1 where they just drew more bombs and beat me. It was very feel bad, but like, oof. Yeah, it's like, I think the fact that it turns off literally the theme of the cycle in such a completely like insane way makes it too strong. I've been arguing with Wama that I don't think it should have been printed, and it should probably immediately be restricted for the past like 3 days.
It is pretty awkward, like you said, with Shadows decks that want to go all in. You know, we've been begging for the theme here for the keyword to get viable, like full-on decks, and like you said, there's a lot of turns where those decks do nothing but only put things into Shadows. Hell, the agenda we're about to get like literally penalizes you for playing characters the regular way, and that's so it feels awkward to have this come out that's going to completely turn something off or turn, you know, even aside from like the unopposed power issue that you mentioned there in challenges, you know, there's a lot of games with the shadow decks I've been playing before where I'm rolling into challenges on 8-10 gold whatever for effects I've got planned, and then not being able to do anything with any of that is also a huge like tempo loss, like money not spent, cards not in play. That
doesn't super duper affect Mara, so we should probably not talk about it now. But like, it's the card I was going to slop. I think that it is. I don't think it's OP so much as it's very unhealthy. There's not a card that says like you can't marshal, right? Like you cannot marshal characters. That would be completely broken. And that's like, if even if that's only for a round, that's completely broken. And that's functionally what this card says.
Yeah,
and yet I've heard from people that want to see dang it, what was the first ed plot that did that?
I mean, it would break second edition, but that's fine.
Yeah, Fear of Winter. There we go. And yet there are people that want that.
Like that would be real bad. Wait, what, Jim? If it were,
I think yeah. No surprises.
Like it also feels real bad when you're playing against Targ. Oop. And like it's like you can't play events. Oh, by the way, I know you were planning on Aegoning. Also, I'm gonna blank Drogon with Mira now, and you can't do anything. And your Dany is now just a 5/3 that does nothing. Yeah. Yeah, I really, really hate that card. Whatever. Next one. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of anti-shadows cards, the last point is that barring the gates is your friend. I think Baratheon. It's in large part because they just have 10 cards.
It decides that's a raider.
They don't have any cards that really interplay during the challenges phase. Besides Desert Raider and, Shadow Shireen, if you do that. But, they're probably the worst Flea Bottom faction in the game. And it doesn't hurt you at all. So they can really leverage Barring the Gates. I think it's a very good, at least 1x in Faith Militant, for example. Where, Brethren in general, you kind of just need to control the game to some extent. Game down, so you can grab your power and go to the next turn, and that's exactly what Barring the Gates.
Yeah.
So, particularly with all the rise of Shadows recently, and the continued rise as we get to the agenda, I think this plot will be very good.
I think Stark just stomps that agenda out of the competitive meta. Like if we have if regionals are a thing that FFG decides to actually give us. That it'll get heavily played for the first couple, and then, people that just are, want to win bad will play Stark, and, I don't think the agenda can survive a single No Surprises, let alone two. What would you do to counter that with that agenda, except be sad? It's Stark, so it's not like you can just hand judgment it, because they've got a brand sitting there looking at you funny.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Stark is definitely very well positioned in Shadows. But, it comes down to a meta call. Maybe I would decide to just play a Kahor deck so that all of their anti-Shadows tech and anti-events does nothing. So there's always that ebb and flow of the meta.
Yep, yep. Okay. My concern, I played a lot of Martell Kohor for a while, like the deck that Matt Gaming came in second with, so on. The issue with, I guess Barrow Rose Kohor is still really well positioned. If it's a positive attachment, I think it works better than a negative attachment deck for Kohor against Stark, but a negative attachment deck runs real headfirst into a Skagos and, as soon as they have Skagos and, an aisle, it's just this is going to go poorly. Also, screw Alejandro. I run 17 attachments in my Martell Kohor. I played it against his Greyjoy Crossing. Three turns, including accounting coppers. Guess how many attachments I saw? Actual zero. Zero. I was like, it was turn three, and I... counting. I'm sitting there. I'm like, well, I've got character. My characters aren't as good as yours. My locations aren't as good as yours. At least I'll see attachments and can, not a single motherfucking attachment. It was the most ridiculous. He was like, yep, that's going to win me the game. I was like, yeah, I wish we played. My deck just didn't do things. It was brutal. Sorry.
I feel like we're transitioning.
Yeah, slaps Alejandro forever. He's too good to get that lucky. That's not fair. You can't be better than me and a million times luckier.
I wanted to share one other brief.
Maybe that's how he got better.
One other brief Barring the Gate story. I played Johnny Wright a couple weeks ago in the Kelly League, and I was playing a Shadows deck, and he played Barring the Gates against me. It was a really feel-bad moment when you're playing Shadows. But I actually had a Nefarious Acolyte in play.
Oh, he told me that. And he had a way to,
And he hear that
and forgot.
Coffee in his hand. But
he told me, he messaged me, he's like, I think that was the worst play I've literally ever made. I was like, yeah, that sounds like the worst play you've possibly made. That's really freaking impressive.
Most people probably wouldn't think to play their Milk of the Pot on a Nefarious Acolyte.
It's the game. Whatchamacallit. I'm done with that Martell Kohor, by the way. I don't play it anymore because right in the finals of the last Cali League, like, I'm playing Johnny, and he's like, well, like, he knows all my decks, obviously. I know all his decks. And so I can't play the Wars because I'm running Naval, and Jesse's name day is like a week later, and I'd really rather the entire tournament not have me see me play Naval on stream, right? So, like, he goes, okay, so he's not playing that, and he's like, I got really bored with Shadows because I play a lot of Shadows. So he was like, oh, he's playing the Kohor. So he played Builders against my Kohor and rolled me. It was a great feeling. So I hate that Kohor now.
Never good.
I mean, I tried really hard. It's just, what was I going to do? He literally played the deck betted perfectly because he had my list. Yeah. Such is life. I'm getting yelled at by my wife. Apparently I got really loud when I got annoyed.
It was noticeable.
Sorry.
So that was all I had for Baratheon tips and tricks. I don't know if you guys had anything else that you think I missed.
No, I think that was a good list.
So I've got one more thing. I think there's ways to use core Stannis really effectively. I don't think that they exist right now, but I don't think they're very far off either. Like, I think core Stannis with Baratheon might just be completely broken if you can keep both on the board. Box Bob Baratheon.
Yeah, I do think core Stannis, you know, has the potential to win a game mm-hmm. itself in the right situation.
I don't know core Stannis?
That if it's good enough right now, but it's a card to...
I mean, if you can only stand two guys and none of them can be cost five or higher or whatever it is, right? Like, you're standing 2-4 costs against my Bob and Stannis stand.
Let's see, does that Robert stop things? Yeah, it's just during the standing. So both of them only stop during the standing phase, though. It kind of worries me that, like, all that would do is just really push Stark again. Maybe push back the Targ stand again.
I don't think Targ stand can survive it. Barry's got a really good matchup against Stark. Stark is the best faction in the game right now, I think. Like, only Greyjoy is really close. I think those two are, like, a fair... I think they're kind of lapping the field right now.
Yeah.
I'd really like to be proven wrong. But, like, Greyjoy can beat Stark, and Stark can beat everything else. Because everything else likes playing events and putting cards in Shadows.
All the factions that kind of had been at the bottom were getting all these sweet new tech using the new mechanics, and then the house already on the top got the card to stop the new mechanic.
I mean,
sounds like a great setup.
I think Lenny Shadows is like already a T1 deck, but I've never seen a deck fold faster than that does to a single No Surprises. It's just so sad. Like, you sit there and you're just, it's a pounding. It's really bad. But, like, Lanny Shadows is freaking phenomenal, except that No Surprises is a card. Like, I can usually handle Greyjoy with it unless they get, like, all the Vints. Like, it's a really great deck, except.
Except.
Well, because it's not like it's just No Surprises, right? It's like, it's No Surprises, and then it's whenever you Mandan or Gregor, they draw a card, and then, like, you try and do this, and they do that. You try and do this, and they do that. It's just really hard. Stark has a lot of answers to a lot of different things right now. Like, I think they're the only faction in the game that can handle literally everything. Because they can handle attachments, characters, events, and locations. And I don't think that's true of anyone else, except maybe Greyjoy. But Greyjoy can't really do much to events.
I mean, they've got some ways to prevent new events being played, so kind of roundabout.
Yeah, okay. So Greyjoy is, like, for game balance, I mean, ideally, like, there's not factions that can do everything, but here we are.
Alright.
Yeah, maybe I think you did talk it up some. I'll buy it.
Alright. I would love to see Baron do well. If anyone uses any of this inspiration to make a fun deck or do well, let me know.
Just for the record, for any listeners, I think the two best Barra decks right now are Barra Sun and Barra Faith. So if you want to mess with them, I think that's where I would start.
Possibly the Barra Rose Gorehor.
Faith is really fun. Yeah. AJ / Jesse have a really cool deck that I don't think's quite as good. But HRD, the one that draws for Nelt characters, which one is that? Is that Blackwater? Yeah, HRD Blackwater Bay. It's really little and really mealy and really fun. Like, it just draws like 6 cards a turn.
Like, sometimes you just draw 6 cards a turn and then lose anyway.
I mean, and lose anyway. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's T1. I just think it's like it might be Barra's most fun build.
Depending on where the meta goes, if there's any more support for it.
I mean, I would assume there's some kind of support for in the box, right?
Is there some more reward?
Yeah.
We can only hope. Well, should we do a little propping and slopping? Sure. Of the items that haven't been propped and slopped already.
I mean, I don't super have anymore.
Sure. Used them all up already?
I really hate no surprises.
Well, it's good that you have something that you're passionate about here.
I guess I'll prop Toronto and Canada in general. I've been working a lot, on this project in Toronto, and I'm up here in the north right now as we record this, and it's been a good time. It's a nice city. Canadians are very nice. I feel like I've started to acquire a very mild Canadian accent.
Oof.
Things like boots or...
I can hear it.
Yeah, I can hear it. It's weird. But anyway, it's been fun. I like it.
Ooh, nice. Well, we don't need to delve too far down the... Oh my goodness.
Season 8
realm is bad, but I will at least say that I thought episode 4 was better than 3... But it's still bad, and I was reading today some stuff on the Song of Ice and Fire Reddit, where I get all of my daily theory love, and read a post there that really, I felt, made it kind of click, that, you know, in good storytelling, there is cause and there is effect. And there's various ways you can play around with that and have multiple causes, multiple effects, and different things. And, you know, the tension sometimes is in not knowing which of the likely effects the cause that we witnessed will come out to be, right? Like, season 1, we saw the cause of Ned being put on, let's say, mock trial here for treason, right? We saw his poor decisions. And the either effects, we see Sansa, we see Cersei telling Joffrey, you know, send him to the wall. We see The other possibility that Joffrey wants to execute him, and we're not sure which way it's actually going to play out. Right? So there's actual tension there. And there's other possible multiple effects and things cascading and stuff. But anyway, I saw this all broken down today, and they pointed out that Season 8, and to some extent the last couple seasons, have just removed all causes. All we are watching is effect, without any understanding of why anything has happened, which has effectively removed all actual tension. And I realized, ah, yes. Because it has definitely felt choppy, like there are pieces missing. And now I know exactly what piece is missing. We're missing all of the effect. Or, sorry, all of the cause. We only have effect.
Yeah, you're definitely right about that stuff. I just don't know. I think they're too limited by the amount of time they have. Think about how long book 5, book 4, book 5 are getting, how long book 6 and 7 will be if they're ever done.
Yeah.
Like, they could easily use another 10.
Oh, yeah.
Just wrapping things up. And like, I don't know. So, to some extent, I give the writers a little bit of a benefit of the doubt, because I don't know if they could really do it all justice. But, yeah, there's certainly some flaws. I loved episode 2. That might have been my favorite
episode. I loved episode 2, and this last episode had weird plotting things, but I liked most of the character moments. Jon Snow can straight up die. You don't leave it all without petting it. I hope you rock it.
Yeah, I mean, the misuse of Ghost since about season 4 is just criminal.
Nope. That's all fine. Like, you can leave him behind, but you can't do a scene where it's like, alright, I'm not gonna take my dog, I'm gonna say bye, and then just be like, peace out, dog, bye. Good thing you got your ear ripped off for me, dumbass. Ha-ha! Like, fuck you, Jon Snow. I hope you burn in hell.
I saw some article from, like, I think the director, that they were just like, yeah, we didn't have the time or budget to do a scene that had both Jon and Ghost in it. So, like, they had to shoot him separately.
There's fucking dragons in every third scene. You cannot, like, they're never, ever going to convince me that doing giant dragon flights are cheaper than a dude petting a dog. You know what you do? You have fucking whatever stupid-ass Jon Snow's actor's name is, pet a real dog, and then you fucking CGI impose Ghost on it, because you already had Ghost there. This isn't hard. It's a shitty excuse.
This is where we are.
I hate John and Danny, so, like, I'm pretty excited for the fact that I'm pretty sure neither one of them end up on the throne.
At this point, I'm pulling for Pod, I think.
I'd be fine with Sansa.
Oh, man.
I could, look, sure. Like, Danny giving Gendry the Storm's End is just ridiculous. Like, for, like, 50 reasons. But, like, it's ridiculous in a way that I buy for her character. It's just a really dumb movie.
Right. But not really knowing Westerosi norms, I agree. I buy it for Dany. It makes sense for her.
Yeah. Well, and she starts by threatening him, which is a shitty move. And she expects the Northerners to be all impressed, but why the fuck do they care? And Storm's Landing is a giant damn, like, huge center of commerce, and she just put a bastard blacksmith with literally no training in charge, so much for breaking the damn wheel. But, like, all her, like, yeah, she's a hypocrite anyway, so it all works.
Yeah, oh, she's never actually going to break the wheel. I'm very certain of that. She is a slave to the wheel.
Well, no, she's gonna die. She's gonna die. She's not breaking shit.
Ah, well. I feel like I had some other stuff. Oh, yeah, you know what? Duh, that's it. I'm going to go ahead and prop, though it will be long by the time this episode airs. But I am going to prop my lovely wife. We both had her 30th birthday on Friday, which we celebrated in style, including sharing a glass of a
40-year Gordon and McPhail's, which was delicious. And our wedding anniversary the night before we recorded this podcast. So, way to be, Kristen. Thanks for putting up with me.
And letting us do the stupid podcast. So long, and thanks for all the cookies.
Fish! The fish!
Kristen's never given me fish.
That can be arranged.
That'd be weird. She walks into a gen pad with like,
not even in a can
like,
anymore. They'll be out like on a tray or something. Artfully arranged.
Okay. Let's not. Hey, you know, by the way, you're both going to Worlds, right? Like, I feel like we have to go to Worlds.
Yeah, exactly.
Clearly
we are making certain that we're going to Worlds, hell or high water, this year.
Jim? Nice. Sounds good to me.
Now that I can drive, no reason to not go. Although, as I say that...
I'm not going to jump down.
Yeah, we're not this year either.
Starting it on a Thursday is a weird, bad decision, but I'll be in Columbia at that point anyway.
Yeah, well, just wait till the world schedule gets announced in mid-October, and you discover that Thrones is starting on Tuesday and concluding on Wednesday.
All right, danger zone. I hate this podcast. Bye.
That closed a chapter.